Hi, and welcome to A Drummer's Guide to the podcast, all about the things that it takes to be a professional musician, aside from actually playing your instrument, which we're going to take as a given. And we're always in process, always in motion with trying to get better at our instruments and just expressing ourselves through our instruments. So to start, I'd like to thank all the lovely Patreon subscribers. You guys are the reason that I've been able to continue doing this podcast, and I just really appreciate you. I just wanted to say that first off, because it's the most important thing, I feel, for me at least, just to show my gratitude to you, basically. So today I would like to talk about some common misconceptions that I feel people have about the role of being a session musician. And some of these have come from other people that have sort of assumed things, reasons that they can't be a session musician, and things like that, and also from my own misconceptions when I was growing up, and how I very quickly, well, maybe not very quickly, very slowly learned that they were not true. My ideas were incorrect. But I just thought it'd be worth sharing these, just in case you also have these misconceptions and they're holding you back from doing things, because I think it's very easy to put blocks in your mind as to why you can't do something. And I know I say this a lot, but as my dad always says, there's always a reason to not do something. You will always find that reason. It's the easiest thing to do. It's the easiest way to cop out rather than doing the scary thing, which is trying. It's terrifying when you kind of, if you have any sort of fear of failure, or if you feel that the undertaking of becoming a session musician or anything else really is just so great, you know, that it's this massive thing that you just can't even bear to kind of enter into it. Let me just say, in my experience, and I'm not talking about my experience as a musician, I'm going to talk about my experience in the last year of my life, because a lot of stuff has happened. I have consistently found that the fear of something feels so much greater than when you start actually just going, okay, I'm just going to do it. And in my case, I haven't had a choice. And that's actually quite a good thing. And actually, when I've come up against things that I've been fearful of the whole of my life, really, you just take small steps and things actually aren't as scary as you think they're going to be. And not only that, my favourite thing that I've learned about myself in the last 12 months, of which I've learned so many things, is I am so much more capable than I thought I was. I feel very capable in certain realms. So in, you know, being a professional musician, say, and what I mean by that is kind of finding a way to make things work. And that's because I am just wired that way. It's because I've always had that way of thinking, and I have so much experience in my past to know that I will find a way to make things work professionally. It's just the way that I am. It's not even a choice. It's just like, cool, all right. And don't get me wrong, sometimes when things go wrong and you're like, oh, this is a nightmare, I acknowledge that, but then it's like, all right, now what? All right, let's move forward. I'm all about moving forward. However, in my home life, I haven't felt like that until recently. And now I'm like, oh, I'm a lot more capable than I thought. And I often find this with creatives. We're really great at problem solving when it comes to creative endeavors. It's fun, you know, but when there's often, I've found, a lacking in, I'm not sure if that's even, that makes sense, but yeah, that sort of the home life, the personal life lacks in aspects that the professional life excel in, which is wild. I've seen it many times. I see it in myself. Let me tell you, we are capable in all aspects. It's awesome. So anyway, right. There's a little misconception that I had about myself. But let's talk about being a professional musician, being a session musician, and what misconceptions I've come up against from myself, from other people. So the one I've seen most recently, quite frequently, and I believe that people come to me with this problem because of how much I've spoken about it over the last will be 4 years. Maybe even 5 years now. Yep, 5 years. And this is the concept that to be a professional musician, you have to read music. And like I say, I've had many people reach out to me saying, I can't be a professional musician because I don't read music. I can't read music. When I turned pro, as it were, sorry, that sounds so idiotic, but when I turned pro, I don't know how else to say that without sounding like an idiot, which was in 2008, I could barely read. I could read drum exercises because that's how I was always taught, that's how I did my lessons from literally pretty much, not maybe not day one, but very early doors with Graham Instrall. Shout out Graham Instrall, someone brought him to my attention the other day. We had another drummer and he was like, we both had lessons with Graham Instrall. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so crazy. Anyway, he taught me to read when I was 11, 12. So I've always been able to read drum music, and for those that don't read drum music, those are often exercises, and they're usually one bar, maybe two, maybe four. That's about it. And it's very clean, the way that it's written. It's very, maybe not simple sometimes, but there's a certain way that it's written for drummers, if that makes sense. And that was the level that I could read to. And if you don't believe me, ask Mike Dolbear. Whenever he would put, now I've been having lessons with Mike since I was 15. I haven't had a lesson probably in about 4 or 5 years, but he is still my drum teacher. He's never getting rid of me. But whenever he would put like music in front of me in terms of having a lesson where we would do sight reading, I would fall apart completely. I would lose all sense of not just the minimal amount of reading that I had, reading ability that I had, but also all sense of musicality and logic, of which I feel like my musicality and my instincts when it comes to playing music is very good. I've played songs all of my life, again, since day one of playing. So it's in my blood. Well, when it comes to certain genres, at least, you know, give me a Cuban song, I'm lost. But, you know, give me a pop, rock, blues, you know, that sort of thing. Unless there's some mad stuff going on, I can pretty much anticipate what's going to happen. However, put music in front of me and I would just fall apart completely. It'd be like I'd been playing for 2 years. I mean, it was embarrassing, honestly. But anyway, I've still managed to have a career for 11 years before I got got confronted with the reality of being offered a gig that needed me to have a high level of reading. And I took that opportunity, even though it terrified me, and I learned how to read. Now, do I think that skill is invaluable? Yes. Do I wish I'd done it earlier? Yeah, probably. Do I think it's essential to having a career? No, absolutely not. It's just another tool in your toolbox. To me, the more tools that you have, the more likely you are to work, the easier you're going to find it to work. And yeah, it just gives you more opportunity. And that you know, that's the case with reading. That's the same with if you play percussion, for instance, which I don't play particularly well, I will say. Same thing for if you learn how to use electronics within your setup, that's going to open up loads more doors for you. If you learn to sing backing vocals, that's going to open up so many more. I lost gigs because I did not do backing vocals. So I got offered the Gold Frap gig years ago. Went down to the guy's studio, you know, had a jam with some songs, got on super well. It was all going really well. They basically offered me the gig right there and then. And as I was packing up, they went, oh, by the way, you do backing vocals, obviously. And I was like, no, I don't. They're like, we need that. Like, that's a non-negotiable. And I was like, I mean, I can like mime a lot, I can sing along if that helps, but like, yeah, you don't need to know my vocals, not great. And they were like, yeah, we're really sorry, like that's a non-negotiable. And I was like, oh, it was heartbreaking. I think that was back in would that have been? Maybe 2010? Yeah, maybe 2010. End of 2010, beginning of 2011. It was a long time ago. But yeah, I was gutted about that. But it's because I just didn't have that skill in my skill set. Have I learned to do backing vocals? No, absolutely not. But, you know, I make my choices. Do I feel like now I could probably tackle that? I probably could. Will I? Not right now. I have bigger fish to fry. Not bigger, other fish to fry. So yeah, in terms of any skill, if there's any skill that you feel like, you know, I can't be a professional because, and there's a skill there that you think is holding you back, I would do one of two things. I would ask other professionals to see if they feel it is essential, because it may not be, and you may be using that as an excuse. I've done it. I've absolutely done it, to not face your fears and not to push forward. And if it is something that is detrimental, or if it's something that is in the way of an opportunity for you, maybe it's time to face it. Maybe it's time to learn to do the thing, the skill that you know, have been avoiding. Again, another one for me is the whole improvisation soloing thing. I've been avoiding that for the whole of my drumming career, aside from the last 2 years. Turns out not as scary as I thought it was. And not only that, it's actually really fun. It's really fun. It's just, it feels very pure and I really like it, you know? So anyway, that's one of the biggest misconceptions I've had recently that a lot of people have come to me with about this reading thing. And again, I think it's because I do talk so much about the Voice Kids, because it's been such a important gig to me in so many respects. I can't even begin to tell you the levels at which that gig has changed my perception of myself as a player. It has increased my ability tenfold, probably more, 20, 30, 40 fold. And then just learning about even just people and relationships, you know, it's so fascinating. It's such a fascinating gig. It highlighted a lot of insecurities that I had very quickly, which is very scary, but I owe a lot to that gig in terms of growth, for sure. So anyway, yes, I think that's why people keep saying, I can't read, that means I can't be professional. No, incorrect. No, don't use that as an excuse. That's not an excuse. I don't think there's many excuses, aside from if you can't physically play the gig. But then, okay, practice, get better. Like, that's now my thing moving forward. If I really want to do something, I will do it. I will find a way. Again, I'm just built that way. I will find a way. I think it's how you've got to be a professional musician. You've got to be a bit... is tenacious the right word? I'm not sure, but it's the one I'm going to use. So there we go. All right. So the next misconception is one that I had growing up. And I think it's one a lot of us have before we realize the reality of what being a professional musician means. And this is an idea that once you get one big gig, as it were, playing with one named artist or whatever, then that's it. You're officially a professional. You kind of cross a threshold and the world is your oyster, and you're going to stay in that position of being a professional, being in work, being busy, maybe even being with that one artist for the rest of their career, for the rest of your career, you know. And this was definitely a misconception that I had, because that is so far from the truth. I can't even. I'm sure you kind of clocked this anyway if you've listened to any of my episodes before. Like, the journey of, or the experience, I'm going to say, of being a professional musician, a session musician, is so tumultuous. It is so up and down. It is a roller coaster. You know, I remember when I first turned pro, again, sorry, in 2008, it was with a band called The Hours, and we were playing pretty decent sized gigs. You know, I was, well, for me personally, it was about the fact that I was being paid, you know, a full-time wage. I was able to move out of home. I was able to, you know, live my life. Not particularly lavishly. Let's not get it twisted here, but I was able to live. And that was always my goal, was like, I just want to live from making music, from playing drums. That's it. That was my goal. And I was doing it. And to me, I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. I've done it. Plant the flag, I'm in. But again, I quickly learned that that was not how it goes. I played with that band for a year and a half. So until from 2008, January 2008, till about March or April, maybe-ish, 2009. And I went from playing gigs like the Royal Albert Hall, for instance, you know, and with playing gigs with Bono as a special guest, to then coming away from that and literally playing, well, covers gigs, playing in like the Puzzle in Hammersmith. Sorry, I've got like the biggest smile on my face because I love these gigs so much. The Redback in Acton. I'm just shouting these out in case anyone listening knows what I'm talking about. And if you do, you will know why I have so much love for these gigs and I miss them. And like the different O'Neills, stuff like that. I was playing again with unsigned, unknown artists in like tiny pubs in Camden. And the juxtaposition and the kind of, I'm not going to say fall from grace because that would suggest that I had done something wrong. It was just the juxtaposition of playing these massive venues with really well-known people to empty rooms again. It was a bit of a shock. And to me, at the time, I was just like, oh, is that it? Was that my time, that year and a half being a professional? And I was in a position now where I was living away from home and it was like, right, well, I'm doing covers gigs again to earn money. Right, I've just got to find a way to make it work again. I'm just built that way. It's like, I will make this work. And I did. And it was hard. It was very difficult. Very difficult for a multitude of reasons. But then, you know, time passed. And in 2010, that's when I got the call to go work with Brian Ferry. And that was like, again, it's this roller coaster of like just up and down. Oh, this world-renowned artist wants me to play with him. All right. Yeah. Amazing. I'm back on top, baby. This is happening. And then, you know, I sort of played in his corporate band and recorded on his album Olympia, obviously, as well. But again, that work was very sporadic. I wasn't in his sort of like main touring band. There were sort of two separate bands. There was a bit of overlap, but there were two separate bands. Don't ask why. Whole long thing. To this day, I'm not actually sure why. But anyway, it was what it was. So then it kind of like, again, there was this juxtaposition of playing like these massive shows and just, you know, really surreal moments and venues and audience members and experiences. So I'd go away one weekend. Like I remember one year for New Year's Eve, we got flown out to Turks and Caicos to go and play Prince's New Year's Eve party. I mean, how much more I'm doing the thing could exist? I just remember being on the beach on New Year's Day just going, wow, this is mad that this is my life. This is mad. But then, you know, the week before, I had played Butlins doing on Christmas Eve. You know? And it was just like this kind of reality hit of like, you're never doing just one thing. There's always, you've got to do all the things. And it was my first kind of, I suppose, realization that there needed to be an acceptance of, you know, it wasn't about different levels of gigs and what you would accept. It was just like, just all the things, just go do all the things, make it work. Like, and in reality at that time, I wasn't able to just rely on doing the one big gig with Brian. I was still doing the Butlins because that was the bread and butter. That was that was actually what was paying my rent regularly, you know? And then as time went on, you know, those bigger gigs, they became more frequent, I suppose. Started playing with Tricky, that was 2011. And then 2012 was Cher Lloyd. And then 2013 was Janet Devlin. And then 2014 was when it was like 80s world suddenly came into my life. And it was the Thompson Twins followed by Howard Jones. And then it was Kim Wilde as well. And then along with that came the Voice Kids. Oh, and then obviously there was the Darkness in with the Thompson Twins as well. And again, it was about sort of juggling these bigger gigs. And that in itself was a whole thing of just trying to make everything work, which it didn't. Oh, Becky Hill as well was around that time. Yeah, 2014 was a mad year, actually. 2014, 2015. So although those sort of like other gigs became less, the covers gigs and whatnot, look, I still do covers gigs. I love them. I really do. They're some of my most favourite gigs ever. There was people that I've known for a long time. They are my family. They are. I love them dearly. I don't get to see them as much as I'd like, but those moments are just so beautiful to me. And weirdly, they almost feel more special than the big gigs playing in front of thousands of people. That probably sounds crazy, but there's something about just being in a pub with your mates playing music and just, again, how pure that feels and how, I don't know, it's where my roots are, it's where my home is, because that's what I grew up doing. You know, in the same way, whenever I play blues music, I just go into this other realm of like, yeah, this is why I do what I do. And it doesn't need to be, it can be in front of four people and I'm happy, honestly. So there's one other misconception I certainly had. Another misconception, again, this is one of my ones. I don't know whether you had this too or have this, but it was this idea that when you get the big gig, when you're going on stage in front of four thousand people, 40,000 people, it doesn't matter, like thousands of people there to see the artist that you're working with, you are going to feel this excitement and it's going to be fireworks and it's going to be this moment of like, oh my god. Personally, no, not the reality at all, because, and I sort of was thinking about this, there's two reasons. I think first of all, I think that the sort of excitement and all that sort of stuff comes from, or the energy comes from like nervousness, from, you know, something being brand new. But the reality is, firstly, if you're going on stage and you're playing a set, the chances are you have played that set probably hundreds of times, hopefully. Hopefully. I wouldn't want to be going on stage in front of a huge audience playing the set for the first time. I've done it. And there's different kind of fireworks. It's not like, oh, this is amazing. It's more like, oh my god. But anyway, so therefore, you almost, well, personally, I almost have to know the material and what I'm about to do to the point of almost boredom, so that I am so not thinking about what I'm doing that I can really take in the moment. But it's, there isn't like a fireworks thing about it, because it's just like, I'm just here doing my job, and I enjoy the experience, obviously, but it's not like, oh my god, it's more like, this is cool, like I'm here, I'm present. And that's kind of my aim when I get onto sort of these bigger stages. But the other thing is, I think that there is a misconception that you go from playing the Dog and Duck tiny pub straight to these giant stages, and actually it's so much more gradual than that. So by the time that you get there, it's like, yeah, this isn't much different from the last level of gigs I was playing, or the last size venues I was playing. If you were going from the Dog and Duck straight to there, yes, that would be a massive adrenaline rush, like, oh my god, this is crazy. But actually it's like, yeah, cool, yeah, this makes sense, this is manageable. Don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that you're still not there going, this is cool, this is like a cool moment. And I certainly have had many of those where you're just like, wow, this is awesome. But there's not like, it's not like fireworks, it's more like, yeah, this makes sense. You know what I mean? I know that doesn't sound very sexy and it doesn't sound very romantic as being a musician, and maybe I rationalize things too much. I'm sure I do. But for me, I think, yeah, that is a sort of, it was a misconception that I certainly had. I thought that it would be this big fireworks moment. But it wasn't. It was just like, because the other thing is, unless it's a festival, when you get on those big stages, you're doing sound check. So it's an empty room, which is nice, because you do get a moment to take it on in and just go, wow, I'm here, we're here, that's really cool. So by the time the audience gets in, you're like, yeah, I know this stage, I know this venue, like, we're just going to do what we do. Which again, I think I find that quite nice. There's a sense of peace there, I think. I don't know. Another common misconception that I think that a lot of people have is that, I was talking to someone about this the other day, people expect that when you're on tour, it's like party, party, party. It's like some mad thing and there's crazy stuff going on. Now, I'm sure that there are tours like that. Let me tell you, that's not my experience. Now, I'm grateful for this, can I just say, because I'm sure you've clocked this about me. I am so not rock and roll. I am so not cool. I am a nerdy drummer. I like my peace. I like my silence. I like my sleep and rest. So for me, touring, I mean, look, don't get me wrong. There are occasional moments that you do have really nice, like, parties or gatherings, if it's like the end of tour or there's a particular gig that's like a big one, like a London show or whatever, which are lovely, and you do have those moments and it is a party and it's great fun. But day to day being on tour, no, it's more about like people finding rest and moments to themselves and being very considerate and chatting. There's always lots of laughter and all that. It is a laugh. It's really good. If you find a good bunch of people to be on the road with, it can be so much fun. And I'm very grateful to say that I have found some wonderful groups of people. That there are certain tours that I will forever love because the amount of laughter and jokes flying around have just been so beautiful and wonderful. But again, it's not party, party, party. We're like all there. We're doing like juicing, or we're, you know, eating really healthy, exercising together. It is not rock and roll, even one iota. So yeah, that is a common misconception. And again, I think that that does hold some people back from pursuing this. I know people that have said to me, you know, but I'm not that kind of personality that would be, you know, partying on tour and, you know, all that side of stuff. And I'm like, look, the majority of tours that I've been on are not like that. There have been a couple that are party, 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 but not really. Not really. So yeah, that shouldn't be something that stands in your way. Yeah, and hey, even if it is party, party, party and it doesn't fit with your personality, that's fine. Move on. It's just it's a mismatch. And that's okay. That's fine. It's not a problem. As long as you don't leave them in the lurch, as it were, with finding a new musician to take your place and whatnot. Like, you know, just get through the tour is what I'd say. Get through the tour when you work out that, oh no, this is a mismatch. And then help, you know, find your replacement, explain, whatever, however you need to deal with it. And then the final thing that I definitely want to address, misconception, is that once you're, you know, playing with a named artist or whatever else, you are now famous. I've seen this too many times where people feel that they, because they're working with someone that is known, they feel that they are entitled to a certain way of conducting themselves and interacting with people and demanding a certain way of being treated. And it is the most heartbreaking thing, for me at least, because I've seen it a lot, and I really hope that I have not fallen foul to this. I really hope. I don't know for sure, and I wouldn't be so arrogant to say that I haven't. I don't know. If I have, it's been unintentional. But let me tell you, there are so many musicians, so many, that I have known since we were young. And that I have known since I was young, and they maybe were slightly older. There's musicians that I've known for a very long time, and then they play with someone that's well known, and they get sucked into the bubble and they start believing the hype. Again, to quote my dad, never believe the hype. And you see a change in them, and you see this, it's an air of, entitlement, I think is the right term. And they feel that they are, They might strut around and feel they're a little too good to chat to anyone or whatnot. And, you know, you talk to them one-on-one and you can see that they're putting on a show. They're putting on who they feel they should be. And it's heartbreaking to me because the people that I know them as they were, if you like, oh man, they're such great people. Like, on the inside, you know them and you're like, dude, you're so cool. Like, please stop this. You don't need to do this. You don't need to act like the famous person. You know, just because a few people know who you are, that's a wonderful thing. Like, awesome. That's so cool. But still just be yourself. Like, still, please. Please, you're a lovely human. But again, I think it all comes from this sort of insecurity and feeling like you should be playing a role of someone that is famous. The other thing is, when you're playing for an artist, I hate to break it to you, you're not famous. You're not. You might feel like it because you're in the bubble and you're being treated well. But when you come out of that, it's like, oh no. In my case, I'm just still a drummer. I am always just a drummer. I don't believe that drummers should be famous. That is a recipe for disaster. You know, we're there as a supporting cast, if you like. We are an instrument that supports the band, the song, the artist. That's it. That's our job. We should not be recognised for anything other than that. And, you know, I had a very small dose of that when I was playing with The Darkness and being recognised by the general public. I didn't enjoy it. It felt very uncomfortable. I felt very exposed. I felt very insecure. And I closed up. I remember there was just one particular incident that happened and I felt myself just like almost like armor coming onto me. And I was, oh, I hate this. Oh my God, I hate this. So not me at all. Whereas, you know, things like doing this podcast, I'm me, I'm open. I'd be as vulnerable as I am physically capable of being, and that's not to say that I don't hold some stuff back, which I do, but I do try and be as open as I'm able with staying, you know, healthy. I'm not sure I am healthy, but staying sane and whatever that means to me. But anyway, yeah, it's again this common misconception that once you're playing with named artists, you are famous, and that can be, you know, that can be a positive or a negative depending on your outlook. Personally, I'd see it as a negative, but yeah, no. If you're being a session musician, no. You're not going to be famous, and B, honestly, if that's the reason you're getting into this world, step right back out, because that's not what we do. At least, I don't know. Look, some people, that's fine. You do you, but that's not what I do. That's not why I'm here. There's a reason that I took up the instrument that's at the back of the stage. There was a time, I remember, I used to think maybe, in fact, there's been multiple times, maybe I should start performing with a balaclava on because then people wouldn't realize, and like baggy clothes, because then people wouldn't realize that I was a girl and make their judgments on me. I just want to be a drummer. I don't want to be noticed. Yeah, I had that for a long time, playing live when I was younger. And even actually when I opened up my remote recording studio, I really thought for a long time about being the anonymous session drummer, because I didn't want my gender to inform anyone about anything. I just wanted to be taken for my playing, for face value. I've always kind of, that's always how I've conducted myself, at least, which I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm not saying it's healthy or unhealthy. I'm just saying that's how I always saw it. The drumming was number one. Everything else is kind of just what's the word? Haphazard is the word that I'm trying to use, but it's not the right one. Coincidental. It was just coincidental. Everything else. Anyway, I'm gonna leave you with that. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do feel free to like, share, and subscribe. If you would like to join the wonderful people over on Patreon to help support this podcast and putting out episodes weekly, you can go to patreon.com/EmilyDrums. That is patreon.com/EmilyDrums. And if you would like to find out about anything else that I do in this world, in this realm of this umbrella of being a professional musician, you can go to emilydrums.com and you can find all the things that I do there, because there are many. I'm racking up the different elements of being a musician over there. So yeah, anyway, I'm gonna love you, I'm gonna leave you. I hope that you're having a wonderful day wherever you are, whatever you're up to, and I will see you next time for another subject. All right, see you later. Bye.